Welcome to We Got Issues. I am Joshua Holland. I'm joined, as always, by alternate managing editor Liz Prezza. Hi, Liz.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well. How are you?
Doing very well.
All right. This week, we've got a great guest. We've got Aaron Regenberg from Never Again Action. This is a group of Jewish Americans who have been taking direct action against ICE detention facilities. They've organized across the country. They're doing really good work, really important work. First, I wanted to talk about this crazy week. Liz, it's very hard to quantify the state of the president's mental acuity because he's a little bit off all the time. But it certainly seems this week, it feels to me anyway, that we've seen a kind of decline into madness.
Yeah, I mean, if it hasn't been there before, it definitely was there this week. So,
I mean, he said he was the king of the Jews. He said he was the chosen one to fight a trade war with China. It seems to me that our political class is unable or maybe fearful of grappling with the ramifications of the guy who holds the nuclear codes, maybe being a few fries short of a Happy Meal, you know?
Yeah, well, I mean, when you're picking a fight with the Danish prime minister in general, you're not really on the winning side there. Like, who's ever come out against the Danes successfully? It just doesn't make any sense. It's such a waste of time.
It is a crazy waste of time. The funny thing is that, you know, Denmark can't actually sell Greenland. Greenland is a semi-autonomous state in the Danish Empire, and they have a constitution of sorts that gives them self-determination. So they would apparently have to hold a referendum in order to. It's just the stupidest thing that I've. And there's a moment like, what, honestly, what is even the point of parody when the president is like freaking out about not being able to buy Greenland?
I know. I was in an airport when this like story first broke, and so all the TVs were like, "Trump wants to buy Greenland," and like everybody was just so confused and so embarrassed. They were just like heads in their hands, could not look at people around them. They're like, "This is the most embarrassing," and it is. It's just embarrassing.
It's so embarrassing. Like, it's embarrassing to be an American right now. It really is.
It's so embarrassing. And honestly, I just read something that apparently he you know, quote unquote, joked about trading Puerto Rico for Greenland. Like, this dude is just like, put the money into Puerto Rico and make Puerto Rico a beautiful, like, it is a beautiful country, obviously, but like, put more infrastructure there if you're so concerned about, I don't know, getting more property. Like, what's his goal here?
His goal is to expand America. And it's funny because the NRCC and a couple of state Republican parties have been fundraising off of this, and they've been selling t-shirts like, expand America into Greenland. Now, meanwhile, you know, like, we've been pushing to make Puerto Rico a state for a very long time.
You could easily
expand America into Puerto Rico, but you know, those people are not so lily white. And so, okay, just to add a little bit to the absurdity of all of this, we have an ambassador to Denmark, right? And honestly, ambassador to Denmark is not a challenging, under normal circumstances, it's not a challenging post, right? Like, right, we don't have like real conflict with Denmark. It's not an
under normal circumstances.
So our ambassador to Denmark is this former chiropractor and former B-movie actress.
Oh, God,
she appeared in this film that was so cheesy that they actually did a Mystery Science Theater 3000 on it. And then she married this ugly rich dude and gave just a boatload of money to Donald Trump's campaign. So that's how she became ambassador to Denmark. And meanwhile, she has a personal Twitter account in which she like shares wackadoodle wingnut conspiracy theories all day long. And so now this person, this woman, is our ambassador who has to like smooth things out with this country that we've just totally like crapped all over. It is mind-boggling. It's mind-boggling.
I'm proud of all of my fellow Americans today. I'm so proud of them.
And I mean, there's something perfect about that, right? Like this cheesy idiot. Like,
a B level actress. Doesn't Donald Trump, doesn't he put people in these roles based off of how he's like staging them in a TV show in his head anyway? Like, isn't that the whole six degree chess that he's playing is really just his grand TV show?
It's so funny that you say that, because the BuzzFeed piece about this said that he appointed her when he was taking a lot of criticism for not having any female advisors. So basically it was like he was like, okay, let's just make this B-movie actress and former chiropractor and ambassador to a country. You can pick the country. Like, he probably said that to Steve Bannon. You pick the country, whatever. And let's get her in the Oval Office for a photo op. And so, yes. And by the way, the idea that he's playing like multidimensional chess, as someone said on Twitter the other day, actually his advisors are just trying to keep him from eating the pieces. And I think that's
Yeah, no, I don't buy into the 8 degree chess thing either. That's too convenient. You're just gonna walk away with, oh, the answer is that Donald Trump is so smart.
That's never the right answer.
That's not gonna be my takeaway from this hellish period we're in.
Honestly,
Donald Trump was actually a genius.
I didn't buy that when they said it about Obama, and he actually was a smart guy.
Oh, no.
Yeah, no. Politics is messy. It's a messy matter of coalition building and all of that. So, and then on a somewhat serious note, I guess.
Correct.
Trump says he's the king of the Jews, and by the way, there was an interesting piece by Yair Rosenberg in the Washington Post. Mm-hmm. So on Alternet, Cody Fenwick wrote a piece this week just pointing out that Trump is just totally trafficking in these anti-Semitic tropes about Jews having dual loyalty. And pretty much everybody in politics embraces that, because anytime you hear somebody say Israel and then the Jewish vote, anytime you hear any kind of like parallel, anything drawing those two together, that is embracing the anti-Semitic trope of dual loyalty. Because there was a poll last year that found 4% of American Jews named Israel as one of their top voting issues. 4%. So, I mean, and there's a much higher rate of... I don't know this, but I imagine that you would get a much higher response rate from evangelical Christians on that one, like 20% or something like that. Anyway, so Yair Rosenberg writes, and other anti-Semitic tropes, you know, Trump has said over the years, he famously said, like, I don't want your money. Like, you won't support me. You're not going to support me because I don't want your money. He said that during the 2015 campaign. At one point, he said, even these spoiled rich Jewish guys, they can't believe how good this golf course is. He said that at one point.
Oh, God.
He was asked about real estate at one point. He said, I'm in a very Jewish business. So, like, okay. So, yeah, Rosenberg, he has this idea. And Trump says, look, my kids are Jewish. My son-in-law, my daughter converted. And Yair Rosenberg, his thing is like, Trump is upset that he has virtually no support in the Jewish community. 80% of Jews voted for Democrats during the 2018 midterms. And he keeps pushing these anti-Semitic tropes, but he thinks he's praising Jews. So his basic argument is that he believes all of this stuff, and
he's applauding their success in business and
like, and being what? Being like being greedy about their money and stuff like that.
God.
He's like, yeah, no, that's
totally true, and I love it. You're great.
Like, okay,
wow.
So here, let me quote just this. So talking about the dual loyalists, Rosenberg writes, and I quote, in other words, he criticized American Jews for not conforming to the anti-Semitic stereotype. That's because, as we've seen, he thinks such stereotypes are praiseworthy. This form of positive anti-Semitism is not as uncommon as you think. A reporter who has covered anti-Semitism for years, I've seen it I've seen it abroad in countries with few Jews, where admiring stereotypes proliferate without much familiarity with actual Jews. So they think, oh, they're good at business. They're money grubbers. They control the media, whatever. Like, that's a good thing. Let's praise them for it.
It's just, wow. Yeah. I didn't even know there were people that thought like that.
I did not either, honestly. I mean, I kind of knew it in terms of, like, I've seen a lot of politicians, like, you know, praise these stereotypical traits, like being good at business. Like, I've seen that one for sure. But I had not kind of put it together until I read Rosenberg's piece in the Washington Post, which you might want to check out. But then on kind of a serious note, again, I don't know if it's really serious. The regime is once again in the middle of this, like, relitigating Jews' belongingness in this country. Is that a word, belongingness? No, probably not. Whether Jews belong in this country as Americans. They have come out once again talking about eliminating, quote, birthright citizenship. And I don't know. It just seems like, are we going to chase the squirrel again? We did this once before.
Yeah, it's not, that's not happening.
it's not happening. And I just feel like he has, you know, he's an idiot savant when it comes to manipulating the media cycle. And when he wants to change the topic, he does it with alacrity. He just, like, we'll throw out something that's so batshit crazy that we all end up talking about it when we maybe shouldn't.
Right. No, I mean, I tend to agree with that. I mean, it's just that's my takeaway too. Like, it's not going to happen. Like, why are we talking about this?
Yeah. I mean, especially when we've been all through it, I believe in late 2000, I'm not sure when it was, late 2017. They did this whole thing and we had a whole, like, 6-week debate, like one of these typical, you know,
people tried to be educational. Like, there was the talkative, the conservative talking point that was like, oh, actually, like, there's this one clause, you know, in that amendment that says this, and therefore maybe they didn't mean. And it's like, no, people, like, it just, if you're born in the United States, you're a U.S. citizen. It's really right there.
Yeah, it's right really. There. It it's is right there. Super right there, and it's really clear. And I mean, look, I get. I know that there are some legal watchers, some cynical legal watchers who say, look, it is a completely nutty argument, but this particular Supreme Court has accepted extremely wackadoodle arguments in a series of cases, right? Like, they effectively dismantled the Voting Rights Act because it worked. That was their argument. It had worked. Mm-hmm. So now we can get rid of it. You know, like, that's a crazy argument. But nonetheless, I think that this is a distraction. Like, there are these legal precedents. They're called super precedents, and they've been affirmed in case after case after case. It's not like this has not been challenged in the past. Right. And it is very hard to see even this Supreme Court taking this argument seriously.
My favorite part about that was, like, that he literally was saying that he was going to do it with an executive order, and people were reporting this like a serious proposition, and it's like, that's ridiculous. Like, an executive order is not going to take out the 14th Amendment of the Constitution. That's just not going to happen.
Yeah.
That's.
Anytime. Yeah, it's just
with a pencil and they'll just erase it, you know, like, it's just, it's so dumb.
It's always, we're always chasing these shiny objects. That is a big problem in the Trump era. You know, he throws some nonsense out there and he's the president, so you kind of have to cover it.
Yeah. Meanwhile, the Senate is just plodding away. They're just, you know, taken over one by one, appointing conservative judges left and right, not taking up any kind of meaningful gun legislation, not even bringing the topic up to debate. It's just, it's crazy.
It is crazy.
There's so much actual stuff going on. And then there's this shit.
Yeah. And did you catch this? Mitch McConnell is warning Democrats against killing the filibuster.
Yeah, I did see that. I mean, I guess it didn't work out for them really when they got rid of the filibuster for federal judges. Because well, that's what he used to nuke the Supreme Court.
Yeah, I mean, it did work out in the sense that they had blockaded Obama's judges completely.
Mm-hmm.
And left, and basically thing. Left them no choice, right? I mean, they either had to accept that Mitch McConnell had shut down the Senate confirmation process for mm-hmm. a Black Democrat, like made up a rule, like Black Democrats don't get to appoint judges, or maybe just Democrats yeah. in general, or they were going to nuke the filibuster for judicial appointments. And if people will remember that it accepted Supreme Court appointments, so then Mitch McConnell nuked it for Supreme Court appointments yeah. to get us these terrible judges. Yeah. So the thing that I find about the filibuster is, so this for me, this is total bluff, because in my mind, you know, they did not, the only reason Mitch McConnell did not nuke the filibuster in the last 2 years is because they have no policy other than cutting taxes on rich people, which right. can pass through reconciliation. So it can right. pass through 51 votes, basically.
Totally if, true.
If they had something that they wanted to, an agenda item that they wanted to advance that could not pass through reconciliation, they would nuke the filibuster first.
Yeah, that's a super interesting point. I hadn't thought about it that way.
They've made it clear that they have absolutely no respect for minority rights, and they've made it clear that they have no respect whatsoever for longstanding norms that make the chamber work. So for me, it's just like he's basically trying to intimidate Democrats out of trying to advance their yeah. agenda. And let's remember that the larger context for this is that, you know, the Democrats in the Senate, the way the Senate is structured to give advantage to small states, the Democrats always have a significant popular vote advantage, right? This is an undemocratic veto point. Mm-hmm. And there's absolutely nothing, excuse me, because the Republicans have moved so far to the right, there's absolutely nothing that the Democrats can do to attract any bipartisan support, any support from the Republican Party for anything, for climate change, for gun control, for anything. So basically, they have a choice between, assuming they get the Senate, which is not going to be easy at all, they have a choice between nuking the filibuster and accomplishing absolutely nothing. That's their choice.
Yeah, yeah.
So for me, it's a no-brainer.
Yeah, totally. Absolutely.
Anyway, we should probably move on with the show. Folks, stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break and then come back with Aaron Ruggenberg. You're going to want to tune in for this one. Welcome back. I'm Joshua Holland, and you're listening to We've Got Issues. Folks, my next guest is doing the Lord's work. Aaron Ruggenberg is a organizer and volunteer with Never Again Action. They are a group of Jewish Americans who have been putting their bodies on the line to shut down ICE detention facilities across the country. Aaron is also a former state legislator in the great state of Rhode Island. Aaron, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much. I'm so glad to be here.
Thank you for taking the time out of your day. I appreciate it. Tell me a little bit about how Never Again Action came to be and came to settle on this strategy of blocking ICE detention facilities.
Well, Never Again Action is the banner under which, at this point, thousands of Jewish Americans alongside immigrants and people really of all faiths have been coming together to say that we are not going to continue to sort of sit idly by and accept this escalating violence and state-sponsored dehumanization against our immigrant brothers and sisters. I think a lot of us have real family experience and sort of historical trauma with what can happen when this kind of violence is allowed to escalate and bystanders do nothing. You know, for me, my grandfather was born in Germany in 1930, and he became a refugee from the Holocaust. He was very lucky to survive. Most of his family did not. And, growing up, I would hear stories about his experience. And I think the thing that was always most disturbing to me was to think about the people in my grandpa's town, you know, his neighbors who saw this escalating violence happening in their community and decided to sit back and let it happen. And so I think what we are trying to do with Never Again, I think the sort of strategy that is shaping the organizing is just trying to think what do we wish that bystanders had done in the 1930s? What do I wish that the people in my grandfather's town, what his neighbors had done? Because we've seen atrocities like what's happening right now in America happened in the past. We've seen bystanders fail that test, and we really, really, really want to make sure that we don't make that same mistake, that we don't fail this test that's happening now.
And I want to make clear to listeners, you know, when you talk about this word escalation, the Trump regime this week unveiled a new rule that would allow the indefinite detention of migrants and asylum seekers. And it's very, very important to understand that the vast majority of people in these detention centers have not committed any crime. Seeking asylum is not a crime. You have a right to present yourself at the border and apply for asylum. Entering the country illegally is a misdemeanor offense. Now, your group has faced violence, most recently by a captain of the guards at a facility you were protesting in your state of Rhode Island. And I have to tell you, Aaron, I found this incident almost more disturbing for the police response than for the apparent crime itself. When you talk about what bystanders do, that really reminded me of this recent incident. You were on the scene. Can you tell us about what happened?
Yeah, absolutely. So last week, hundreds of Rhode Islanders came together to demonstrate at the Wyatt Detention Facility, which is the one sort of for-profit prison in Rhode Island that has partnered with ICE and is serving as an ICE detention facility. We came together for the week of Tisha B'Av. That's the sort of most powerful Jewish day of mourning in order to collectively mourn this violence that's happening in our community and to say that we're not going to allow local Rhode Island institutions like the Wyatt to partner with ICE in perpetrating this violence. So it was a really beautiful action. It was a peaceful demonstration. It was full of prayer and song. There were faith leaders there. There were rabbis. There were priests. There were imams. And then at one point, a captain from the prison drove his truck into a line of peaceful protesters. There were youth. There were minors on that line. There were senior citizens. A few people were hospitalized. Luckily, no one was really severely hurt, but people were definitely in harm's way. And then right after that, a squad of corrections officers from this for-profit prison marched out and pepper sprayed this crowd. Again, that included, my 72-year-old friend Ellen was pepper sprayed directly in her face. She had to be hospitalized. And I think the main lesson for us, as sort of scary as that was to experience that violence, was really to think about if this system is willing to unleash that kind of violence on peaceful protesters in front of media and cameras and lawyers, like what kind of violence is happening behind those walls? What are these detainees who don't have any of those resources, who don't have cameras, who don't have lawyers? What are they being subject to day in and day out? And we're really, it was a pretty horrific experience, but we're hoping that, it wasn't in vain and that people, we'll see how violent the system is, and that it's really too violent to continue.
And the captain who drove the truck was suspended and subsequently resigned. There were officers from the Central Falls Police Department, the local police department, on scene. What did they do as they witnessed this assault?
So it was really concerning to all of us, the police response. I think if most people had driven a truck, you know, that's deadly force into a crowd of peaceful protesters, certainly if anyone of color had done that, they would have been arrested on the spot, right?
Well, if somebody of color had done that, there might have been gunplay.
I mean, in Rhode Island last year, there was a police shooting, a lethal police shooting, in response to someone who was in their car and was sort of blocked on the highway, and they were trying to escape, and so they sort of drove their truck into another car, and so they said that was deadly force and killed him. So, that's concerning. I think there is sort of, I want to be clear that none of the violence inflicted on us was done by the police, but I think there is that sort of, that sense of solidarity in law enforcement between police and corrections officers. And there was definitely a refusal to do what I think was clearly the right and responsible thing there,
which would be to arrest him. And then, you witnesses
arrest him, and honestly, the rest of the corrections officers who were mostly on public property, they certainly didn't have authority to be pepper spraying minors and senior citizens, outside of the jail. To us, we think that was also assault. But I also want to just really stress that, that was a scary experience, but that's just sort of a shadow of a taste of the kind of violence that, you know, detainees are experiencing, the kind of fear that our immigrant families and neighbors are living through every single day in our community because of this system. And really, that needs to be what this fight is about.
I understand that is an important emphasis, but I just want people to understand that not only did local police watch this serious assault unfold right before their eyes, but they refused to take witness statements from the victims. And, you know, I wasn't there, but on its face, it certainly seems that they did this because of the solidarity that you just talked about with the correctional guards of this private facility, but also because they didn't approve of the victims' political stances. And we talk about, you know, creeping fascism. I mean, when you have police who are, you know, whatever your criticism of police, you expect them to enforce the law when it is violated right in front of their eyes. And this is not a minor crime. This is vehicular assault. We're in an era when protesters have been murdered by white supremacists using cars to run them down. It's outrageous that they sat there and did nothing. And according to WBUR, the local radio, an investigation by the state attorney general and state police is underway, but, quote, it remains focused on how some protesters were struck by a pickup truck driven by a corrections officer and hit with pepper spray. So it looks like the police response, that is, the police apparently ignoring a crime being committed in front of their eyes because they did not believe in the victim's political perspective, that isn't being looked at. Aaron, I just find that outrageous. Now, you also have five members of Never Again Action facing possible prison terms in Texas. What is the story down in the Lone Star State? Can you tell us about that?
Well, being from Rhode Island, I'm not 100% an expert on this, but I think it's not a new tactic for the state to use outsized punishment to try to tamp down on activism, organizing, and civil disobedience. This is clearly a fear tactic to try to ensure that more people aren't joining this movement. I think it shows the power of what folks coming together and putting their bodies on the line can achieve. That there is this kind of reaction. And honestly, I think the state in Texas is right to be scared. There's a lot of power when people come together and say that, you know, attack on one is an attack on all. Last week was our second demonstration at the Wyatt under this banner of Never Again. We had one in July that a number of us were arrested at for civil disobedience. And I think that, you know, that happening inspired a lot more people, hundreds more people to come out last week to this action. So it's growing, and authorities that support this system of violence and deportation are reacting to try to tamp it down however they can. And I think we're all pretty strongly committed to making sure that doesn't happen. We're in this fight for the long haul.
Just to fill in the details, the factual details of this, there was an action in front of a detention facility in Houston, and five activists were arrested for obstructing a highway. And basically, you know, to make a long story short, the authorities are throwing the book at them in a way that is not typical for this kind of charge. So they appeared in court. They tried to have the charges dismissed. That did not happen. And we'll see how this story progresses, but they do face up to 6 months in jail and a $2,000 fine. And organizers for Never Again Action said, you know, actually it was the people who were arrested themselves said in a powerful statement, they said, you know what, we'll do 6 months. We'll do it. It's worth it. It's worth it to us to not stand around and sit idly by while these abuses are going on. Let me ask you about this idea.
I was just reiterating that there's a lot of power in that.
There is a lot of power in that. I mean, this is, it's funny because we were talking about Antifa a couple of episodes ago, and you know, whatever issues you have with Antifa, I'm not comparing your organization with Antifa, but one of my guests made a point that said, look, these are the only people who are actually putting it on the line and going and directly confronting fascism. So whatever you may think of their tactics, you need to give them the credit for having the courage of their convictions to actually do something as opposed to sitting in their keyboard and complaining about it on Twitter. Let me ask you about this idea of Never Again. The regime's detention centers meet the definition of concentration camps. It's that simple. There was a big political kerfuffle over this terminology. I guess there still is a political kerfuffle over this terminology. Apologists for putting migrants and asylum seekers in cages said it was a comparison to the Holocaust. Many people, like me, said that that was a dishonest argument because concentration camp is not a term that originated in Nazi Germany, and there have been countless concentration camps in dozens of countries that were not death camps, right? Including in the U.S., we've had them before. Is there any concern that explicitly invoking the Holocaust, you might obscure the reality that we don't think these camps are the actual equivalent to like Dachau?
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. When we talk about the Holocaust, we're not just talking about how the Holocaust ended, right? We're talking about how the Holocaust began and then escalated through a gradual process of state-sponsored dehumanization, of scapegoating of vulnerable populations in order to make up for economic anxieties in a base of a nation's people, escalating violence against people. That is the gradual process that led eventually to the murder of my grandfather's family and so many millions of others. And so when you look at that process, I think it's very hard for anyone who is versed in the history to not see the validity of that comparison. We are experiencing atrocities. We're seeing concentration camps being operated in our name, under our flag. You know, there's a something that, you know, a thing that people have been repeating, which I think is important. Anne Frank didn't die in a gas chamber. She died in of typhus in a concentration camp that was made up of appalling conditions without access to medical care. And we have seen deaths in these concentration camps because of lack of access to medical services and because of appalling conditions. So we're not in Germany in 1945 right now. But when you look at Germany in 1934, there's a lot of comparisons, and all of us who have that family history, I think, wish that the people of Germany had stood up to stop that process, to say, we're going to do anything we can. We're going to put our bodies in line. We're going to get into the gears of this process that's moving forward to make sure it doesn't end up there. And that is, I think, the focus of our work today.
It's really important work. Aaron, I want to switch gears with you a little bit and ask you to take off your representative hat. And I wonder if you could talk to me a little bit more broadly about the Jewish experience in Trump's America. I was talking to a friend the other day, and I told him that as a secular Jew who doesn't have a particularly Jewish name, and, you know, I had never identified as a member of a minority group in any way. I grew up in New York. I've always thought about myself as like just a straight white dude. And I'm pushing 50. And that only changed when Trump came along and energized the crazies and started activating all of these extremists. And it's only since 2015 that I felt like I belong to a minority, and that it's only since 2015 that I've received, for example, like blatantly anti-Semitic abuse from political opponents on social media, for example. That never happened to me before. I wonder if that's an experience you can relate to, or one that you've heard from your fellow volunteers at all.
Yeah, I think this is a really interesting time to be a Jew in America. And I think it's a time that actually puts a great deal of responsibility on our shoulders as people who were not always white, but became white and like are white now. There's a level of privilege and power that we have in our white supremacists culture, you know, a culture that has, you know, racism, et cetera, through it. The fact that last week, it took white bodies being on the line and, you know, put in real harm's way for here in Rhode Island for us to get so much attention on the detention facility when we know that, you know, black and brown bodies have been being put on the line in harm's way for a long, long time. So there's some power there, but we're also a people that, again, we understand what it's like to be on the other end. And so there is we're in a unique, I think, place of responsibility to our Jewish tradition of tikkun olam, of tzedek, of fighting for justice. And all of that is also not to say that we also aren't actually directly targets right now. The white supremacist movement that Donald Trump has helped to inflame and bring out into the open and normalize, is directly targeted at the Jewish community, alongside being directly targeted at people of color and immigrants. This is a more dangerous time for us than we've seen in a while. And again, I think that it is one more reason for us to say we need to be focused on solidarity. We need to be focused on fighting together and alongside other folks that are targets. An attack against one is an attack against all, and, you know, together, separately, we don't have the power to take on this president and all of these systems of oppression, but together there's a lot of power there.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. The importance of solidarity with other people is it just can't be overstated, because right now you see a lot of people who's, as you say, we're not always white, and we became white. whiteness is obviously a social construct, but our whiteness is being relitigated now for the first time in our lifetimes, I think, certainly in the post-war era. And it's important for us to understand that, you know, what we're only starting to see a little bit of it is something that, for example, Muslim Americans and people of color have experienced to a much greater degree and continue to experience to a greater degree than we do. And I hope that this era will lead to a lot more understanding of that interconnectedness.
And the last thing I'll say is that, you know, I've been a Jew all my life. I've been, you know, I was bar mitzvahed. I went to synagogue every week. I continued after my bar mitzvah and taught at my synagogue. So there was always, it's always been a part of my life, but as someone who sort of had a Jewish identity and then had a sort of an organizing, and social justice identity, this experience right now to see those two identities and communities coming together, to see the Jewish community taking a real leadership role in the fights of our time, it brings me a lot of pride, because I think that is a role that we've had in the past. We played an important role in the civil rights movement. We played an important role in the labor movement in the 30s. But I think for a lot of ways, for much of my life, it didn't actually feel like the Jewish community was at the forefront. I think the right wing had a real strategy around trying to win over and to some degree successfully a segment of our community. And so being in this moment right now where young Jews and older Jews, you know, this is an intergenerational movement, are standing up and saying, this is who we are. This is what our tradition is. We could not be true to our Jewish history and our ancestors and that promise that we grew up with of never again, if we weren't in this fight. It brings a lot of pride for me as a Jew.
Aaron, I have to tell you, it's so rare in the Trump era to end a segment on an uplifting note. Thank you for that. Usually it's just depressing. Aaron Regenberg, tell me, how can listeners get involved if they want to? And how can they support you even if they can't actually put their bodies on the line?
So I'll say a couple things. You know, Never Again is a movement across the country. There are organizing and actions happening all over. I mentioned my grandfather and how his experience as a Holocaust refugee is part of what inspired me into this fight. 2 weeks ago, my 89-year-old grandfather and my 87-year-old grandmother were able to take part in a Never Again demonstration against ICE in New York. So wherever you are, if you look up Never Again, you'll be able to find a way to plug in and organizing that's happening in your area. And obviously, Never Again is new on the scene. There has been organizing happening against ICE for immigrant rights and across these other issues we've been talking about, led by frontline communities since time immemorial. And it's really important that we are elevating that work and engaging in that work as well. So, you know, it's different in every locality, but it's a time when I think people are open to new folks showing up and mobilizing and becoming leaders in this movement. So I encourage everyone to check it out.
Aaron Regenberg from Never Again Action. Folks, do just Google it and get involved. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
I'd also like to thank Liz Prezza and David Edwards, our producer and engineer. I'd like to thank the good folks at Alternet and Raw Story, John Byrne and Roxanne Cooper, for supporting the show. You can finally subscribe to the show on iTunes, as you should. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall, as you also should. Of course, I would like to thank all of you good people for tuning in. Have a terrific week.
Soft like a whisper, kiss me goodnight. I feel your heart beating with mine.